That the words of my mouth and the meditations of our hearts be acceptable in your sight, O Lord, our strength and our Redeemer. Amen. Several years ago, I heard a man tell a story of being with a group of Middle Eastern men and beginning to share the parable of the prodigal son. And he was struck by how these men reacted to this parable. And we hear the story and we hear it over and over again, and it becomes so familiar to us that we say, what a beautiful story. Isn't that wonderful? Isn't it great? Great story, Jesus. But these Middle Eastern men reacted with shock. They were stunned and shocked at this story. And we can only assume that Jesus' first hearers, Middle Eastern men, would have reacted with the same kind of shock. And what I'd like to do this morning is reflect on this parable of the prodigal son that we know so well and we respond to generally so favorably, and try to get a sense of why this story would have been so shocking to Jesus' first hearers, and why it may still be shocking to us if we hear it aright. So we're in Luke chapter 15, and we're in a key moment in Jesus' ministry. From the beginning, Jesus has outlined his ministry. In Luke chapter 4, he gave his first sermon, quoted Isaiah 61, "The Spirit of the Lord is upon me. He's anointed me to preach good news to the poor, proclaim release to the captives, recovery of sight to the blind, freedom for the oppressed, and to proclaim the favorable year of the Lord." And he began to go about doing just those things. And surprisingly, he encountered quite stiff opposition from the religious leaders of the time, those who had a vested interest in maintaining the status quo. And the emphases of the religious leaders of the time were very much on how we behaved relative to a set of commands. And these commands specifically had a lot to do with purity. So did you wash your hands correctly? Did you eat correctly? Did you avoid the sinful, dirty people correctly? In other words, what is it that makes someone a faithful follower of the one God? And to the scribes and the Pharisees, it was following a specific set of rules that had primarily to do with external purity, that had them avoiding whole swaths of people in order to keep themselves unstained by the unclean. And so when Jesus went around and started touching lepers, when he started allowing sinful women to wash his feet with their hair, when he started disregarding the Sabbath prohibitions against healing and against eating on the Sabbath in a certain way, he offended these religious leaders. And so in Luke chapter 15, we see that tax collectors, again, who were seen as traitors, who were seen as corrupt by the religious leaders, and frankly, we would probably agree with that assessment, knowing a lot of how tax collection functioned at that time, and sinners. And this was a whole group of people, again, who had transgressed not only the purity laws, but the Old Testament laws, the Ten Commandments. These were a group of people that were set apart, that were to be avoided, that were to be shunned, lest they make our pure selves dirty. These were the kind of people that were coming to Jesus, and he was welcoming them, and they were sharing meals together. Sharing a meal in that time, in that place, was a deep sign of fellowship. It was a deep sign of friendship. It was a sign of favor and acceptance. And the scribes and the Pharisees were mumbling, grumbling. Calls to mind the children of Israel in the wilderness who murmured against Moses and Aaron. And so this prompts Jesus to tell three stories. The first story is about the sheep, or the shepherd, who searches for the lost sheep. The second story is about a woman who searches for her lost coin. And then finally, the stories of the prodigal son. And many scholars have observed that this parable of the prodigal son might better be called the parable of the two sons. It's not only about the prodigal, but the elder brother is actually fairly key to the story. Maybe we should even call it the parable of the loving father. But I want you to understand how shocking this story would have been to those first hearers. Well, we hear that a man had two sons, nothing shocking about that. But we hear that the youngest son came to his father and said, "Can you please give me that which I would inherit from you?" This is shock number one. Because what this younger son was essentially saying to his father is, "I wish you were dead. Give me my stuff." Okay, shock number one. Shock number two is that the father said, "Okay." This was an act of a profound shame that the younger son was bringing on his father, and most self-respecting fathers would have responded by expelling the younger son, turning him away, and never welcoming him back because of the profound shame that had been brought upon the father. But this father says, "Okay, one third of my household is now yours. One third of my property is now yours. One third of the land is now yours. It's done. It's no longer mine. It's yours." And then the next shock is that the son actually began to sell things off. He began to sell land. He began to sell equipment. He began to sell livestock. And he got the cash and he just left. And that's why later on, the father says, "My son was dead and now he's alive." The fact that the son did this, it was though he was dead to the family and he went away, the son did, to a far country. Okay, next shock is that the son squanders all of his money in dissolute living, the text says. He was hanging out with prostitutes. He was spending more than he had. He was participating in wild parties, those sorts of things. And then he ran out of money, and there was a famine in the land, and he needed to eat. And so he found himself hired by a guy who wanted him to take care of the pigs. Now, this is a shock right here, because again, for a first century Jew or people in the modern Middle East, pork is forbidden. The fact that a good Jewish boy would wind up in the pig fields was the ultimate sign of failure. And to the scribes and the Pharisees, this was the ultimate sign of transgressing the purity boundaries that they found so important. And so we have the younger son, having wished death upon his father, gone away to a far country, and finds himself hitting rock bottom with the pigs. And so then the son comes to his senses, and he realizes that if he could go to his father, then he could offer to work for his father. He'd no longer be a son. He's lost that right. But maybe he could work for his father. And maybe sometime over his life, he could repay his father for all that he's stolen. He could be a hired hand. And so maybe his father would receive him back. And he has this elaborate confession that he's going to make to his father and this elaborate plan that he's going to propose to his father. And maybe, just maybe, the father might have mercy on him. But who knows? It was an open question. And Jesus' first hearers, and maybe some modern hearers, would say, "No way. There is no way that any self-respecting father would accept this kind of a deal from his son who said, 'I wish you were dead.'" And so then the son begins to go home. And what we find is not an angry father. What we find is not a father who has gotten on with his life. But rather we find a father who is looking down the road, sitting, waiting for his son to come home. And when he sees his son in the distance, next shock, the father gets up off the porch and begins to sprint. This was incredibly undignified behavior for a proper, respected man at the time. To sprint, and not only to sprint, but to sprint toward this child who wishes you were dead. What kind of a self-respecting person would do something like that? And yet the Father embraces the Son and clothes the Son and celebrates the Son. You notice that the Son didn't even get down on his knees and say sorry. He didn't even get to make his proposal that he wouldn't be a son, that he would be a hired hand, because he had been embraced and loved and celebrated by his Father for no other reason than that this was the Father's child. And the Father loves his child. And the Father had feared that his Son was dead. But when he saw that his Son was alive and coming home, he couldn't do anything else but run that sprint, that embrace, and welcome him and celebrate him. Shocking. Shocking. Now we get to the elder brother. The elder brother is working out in the field. Presumably he's working really hard. And he hears the celebration going on. He asks one of the servants, what's going on? And he says, your brother has come home, and your dad is celebrating. He's even killed the fatted calf. And of course, the fatted calf was that special meal that you only used when something amazing was going on. And the reaction of the elder son is anger. I cannot believe that my father is letting this go on. I cannot believe that my father has not only welcomed this person that I don't even consider my brother anymore, this person that's brought shame and disgrace on our family. He's never even let me have a little party with my friends with a goat, much less the fatted calf. I cannot believe the kind of behavior that my father is engaging in. This is disgraceful behavior. But you see what's happening here, that the elder son's reaction to his father's behavior is similar to the younger son's reaction to his father. I mean, the younger son said, Dad, I wish you were dead. Give me my stuff. But now the elder son is saying, I'm so angry. I can't believe, Father, that you're acting like this. This is completely unacceptable. Both sons, critical of their father, disrespectful to their father. And now we find that the father comes and searches for the elder brother, for his eldest son. He leaves the party that he's having because his younger son, who is dead, is now alive, and he goes and looks for his eldest son. And they have this exchange, and the father says, everything I have is yours. Please come celebrate. Because your brother was dead, and now he's alive. And that's where the story ends. The question is, will the elder brother come and join the party? Because the elder brother, for all of his goodness, for all of his moral behavior, for all of his respect that he's shown his father throughout his life, now finds himself separated from the party that his father is throwing. But the father is not content to have him separated. He's going to look for his elder son, the prodigal's elder brother, because he longs for the elder brother, his eldest son, to celebrate as well. And of course, it's fairly obvious what Jesus is doing here. He's telling the scribes and the Pharisees, good for you for behaving well. That's awesome. I'm so thankful that you behave well. It's people like you that keep the trains running on time. Good job. Here's what I'm doing now, Jesus is saying. I'm searching out these divine image bearers who are far from God. This is why I'm here, and this is what I'm doing. And so there's a party going on every single time one of these divine image bearers comes to their senses and comes home. And this party is going on now. And you, scribes and Pharisees, are now in perilous danger because you're refusing to join in the party. And so Jesus is saying, please, please don't let your good behavior keep you from what I'm doing. Don't let your good behavior, ironically, create a barrier between you and God. You see, that was what was going on. The Pharisees and the scribes were so offended by what Jesus was doing that they ironically found themselves separated from God, in desperate need of reconciliation. In fact, maybe more in need of reconciliation with God than the tax collectors and the sinners who were responding to Jesus and who Jesus was welcoming. And from this shocking parable, then, we learn something about the nature of God. We learn that God is first and foremost one who is defined by sacrificial love. God is not a cosmic police officer. God is not waiting with a stick for somebody to transgress arbitrary rules so that he can beat them down. God is not even an absentee father, an absentee landlord. But God, first and foremost, is defined by sacrificial love. That is God's nature. We see that nature displayed in the creation. We see that nature displayed all throughout sacred history. God giving himself to restore what's been broken. We also have a revelation of the heart of God. When we read that the Father was moved with compassion or moved with pity, that becomes a revelation, a manifestation of God's heart for humanity. God is primarily one who feels deep pain and compassion for those who are broken. That's what God's heart is like. God's not a cosmic scorekeeper. God's not a cosmic rule keeper. God is one whose heart breaks with compassion for those who are farthest from him. And we see this compassion displayed throughout the ministry of Jesus. When he sees the widow whose son has died, he's moved with pity and goes to bring healing. When he sees the crowd who had gathered, who's hungry, he's moved with compassion and he brings food. And we see the same word come up in the parable of the Good Samaritan, where the religious people passed by on the other side. They didn't want to get dirty because of this person who's broken on the side of the road. They had more important things to do, like church meetings. Those are important, right? The more important things to do, like church meetings. But the Samaritan, the arch enemy of the Jewish people, was moved with compassion and came and tended the needs of the one on the side of the road. And so we get a glimpse of God's heart, which is a heart that's moved with compassion for those that are broken, those that are farthest from God. And finally, we have a clear demonstration of Jesus' mission and ministry, which is, as Jesus will repeat in Luke chapter 19 after his encounter with Zacchaeus, that the Son of Man came to seek and to save that which is lost. And so the scribes and the Pharisees, Jesus says, good for you for being moral. Good for you for behaving well. I'm interested to seek and to save those who are lost, and they're coming, and I'm celebrating. And suddenly, scribes and Pharisees, I'm discovering that you're now the ones who are lost because you're refusing to join in. And so now I'm seeking and saving you too. The father goes to the elder brother, just like he ran to the younger brother. And so because we have this glimpse into the ministry of Jesus, which of course culminates on the cross, when he demonstrates sacrificial love, he demonstrates compassion, and he demonstrates his desire to seek and to save that which is lost. And that has implications for each one of us. It could be this morning that some of you empathize with the younger brother. You know what it's like to go and sow your wild oats, to get involved in really bad and irresponsible behavior, and you feel profoundly guilty. And maybe you're here Sunday after Sunday, but you've never quite believed that God would actually want you as his child again. Maybe you feel like you're the hired hand. At best, you're lucky to be the hired hand. But maybe today you could embrace the fact that God wants to embrace you and love you as his child. But maybe like most of us, you can most empathize with the elder brother. Those who do their best to behave well, who like to do the right thing, who get frustrated when people are misbehaving. And so I think that the Father would say to you this morning, good for you. I like people who care about doing the right thing. I like justice. I like rectitude. That's great. But I wonder this morning if you might find yourself on the outside when you hear this scandalous story of the father going to embrace the prodigal, to embrace the sinner, to embrace the one who wished him dead, that we might scratch our head and say, but doesn't my good behavior count for anything? I mean, does it mean anything that I try so hard? And can you hear the father come tenderly to you and say, of course I care that you try so hard. But what's going on now is a celebration for all who are lost. And do you know what? In the midst of your good behavior, you're lost too. And this party's for you just as much as it's for him. And so can you come and join the party as well? And so in the Eucharist, we set this table. And it's not the fatted calf that's been killed, but Jesus himself. And he's done that to show us the nature of God, the heart of God, to show us why Jesus came in the first place. Elder brother, younger brother, sinner, righteous, we all find that we're invited to this table, we're invited to this feast, and I pray that we could all receive from his depths this morning. Amen.